Welcome to chemistry. Yeah, happy Monday. Let's see here. I've returned one graded lab to you this morning, the microscale density one. I'm actually almost finished with the one after that, the limiting reactant one. So I should be able to finish that either when you're in lab or tonight or something like that. So you can look for that one. We'll talk about this a little more in lab, but I will give you opportunities to revise the reports that you've submitted before now with the feedback that you're getting from these ones that I'm giving you. So we'll talk about that. I'll make an opportunity for revision of the previously submitted reports so you can learn from your mistakes. I think that's the whole point of this whole exercise. So you had a mastering chemistry assignment due last Friday. We'll have another one that will most likely be due this Friday. I don't know, we're a little behind on lecture, so we'll see what we get through on Wednesday. But the exam will be a week from today, no matter what we get through, and the exam will just cover the material that we have gotten through in class before that. So, you guys have any questions? Well, yes. When? This Wednesday?
Yeah, look at the little slip.
That very well could be. From G202 from 1:30 to 3? Oh, it would have been nice if they would have told me about that. I don't know. If they're making us move, there'll be a sign on the door telling us where to go. So. Yeah, one would think.
I don't know why we're in this.
What's that? Why we're in this room?
Is available.
In that room?
It's
not on Mondays. I think during this period, I think this is the one that's only available on Monday and Wednesday. There are other rooms that are available during one day. So. Yeah, we could be sitting on the floor or something.
Is this too small?
Well, you know, if a room is too comfortable, then it makes it easier for you to fall asleep. So, yeah. All right.
The class is too interesting to fall asleep.
Jeez. Oh yeah, of course. Right after lunch.
Sure.
But anyway, I found that we make it work. We tend to make it work. I haven't seen any difference in exam scores based on what room the course has been taught in. So, all right. So we have one page left from our gases chapter that puts our discussion of gas laws into the real world just a little bit. The ideal gas law and the equations that we've used tend to be very accurate under, should we say, normal conditions. So around one atmosphere, around normal temperatures, things like that. But if we start deviating from that an awful lot, if we go to extreme temperatures or extreme pressures, those assumptions that we made about kinetic molecular theory tend to break down. So it is accurate when the volume of a gas particles is small compared to the space between them, right? Remember we said that for a normal gas sample, the actual size of those molecules is negligible compared to the amount of empty space. Essentially, those gas molecules act independently of each other. Okay? And as long as the attractive forces between gas molecules are not significant. We said that the collisions between gas molecules, we assume them to be elastic, and that all the energy from one is transferred to the next. But if there are attractive forces between those molecules, collisions become less elastic. So some of the energy is used in the attraction of those molecules together. So these assumptions are valid around standard temperature and pressure. Okay? So around one atmosphere, what's the standard temperature again?
Zero
Celsius. So, and by extension, room temperature isn't very far from zero Celsius on the Kelvin scale, right? 293 versus 273. So, assumptions work pretty well, but let's look at two circumstances. Let's think about what happens when the pressure is much higher than one atmosphere. So, say we're in a container of pressurized gas, like a pressurized gas cylinder, right, that gases are transported in, that have very, very high pressures, several hundred atmospheres sometimes. Okay? When there are higher pressures, the molecules themselves take up a significant amount of the sample's volume. Why is that? If something is very high pressure, of course, what is it that causes pressure? What? Yeah, it's the molecules hitting the surface, the inside surface of the container. So if it's very high pressure, there are lots and lots of those collisions, which means there's lots of molecules packed into that space. So we can no longer assume that the gas is almost completely empty space and that the particles themselves don't matter. Once we get beyond a certain point, the actual size of those particles does start to matter, right? So the molecules themselves take up a significant amount of the sample's volume. Remember, ideal gas law predicts the molecules will have no volume. So think about this. Don't say anything out loud. Just think in your head about how this will compare. Ideal gas law says the molecules will have no volume. The actual volume, will the actual volume be greater than this or less than this? Don't just think in your head. Okay? Think about the assumption that we made and what actually happens at high pressures. What do you think? Will the actual volume be lower? Will the actual volume be higher than what we predict? Higher? Well, we can assume that they have no volume if the volume of the molecules is not significant in terms of the entire sample. But if we have really high pressure and we have pretty much as much volume taken up by the gas molecules as is by empty space, then that becomes important. So calculating the volume of those molecules, taking that into account, will mean that the actual sample has more volume than what we would have predicted, because we predicted that it had no volume. Right? So the actual volume will be higher than the prediction. Okay. So the original ideal gas law, right? Pivnert. We need to change V to account for this. Okay? If the actual volume is higher than the prediction, to get back to something that we could calculate, the volume becomes V minus N times B, where B is just some constant. That represents molecular volume. Okay? So, to get back to something that the ideal gas law is able to do, okay, we need to subtract out the volume of those molecules. Okay? This gets us back into something that would be ideal. So, the actual volume minus, what's lowercase n? Number of moles times B, which is a representation of the volume of those molecules. Okay? So if we subtract out the volume of molecules, that gets us back to an ideal state that we can that fits with our calculations once again. Okay? So what we did, we have something that's creeping in that's messing with our calculations because we assumed it to be zero before. So we'll subtract that factor back out. In order to be, for it to become an ideal calculation unit. Does that make sense? Okay.
How higher is much higher?
Well, usually several hundred ATM. if it's any pressure that we can actually manipulate, you know, squeezing a piston or something like that, it's not going to be a factor. But it is a factor in things like compressed gas cylinders and stuff like that. Yeah?
Do you have any problems like this on the test? Will you give us value for B and stuff like that?
Or? You know, no. Well, the pressure calculation is a little more complex even. As far as the exam, what I would maybe be able to have would be a question that asked why it is that volume needs to be corrected for, or something like that, or you know, has you explain why V becomes V minus NB or something like that. So having a familiarity with these things is a little more important, I think, than being able to plug into some equation that'll chew up 15 minutes of your time on an exam. That's not important. But I think it is important that, you know, and having an understanding of these equations gets us right back to why it is that real gases don't behave in this ideal manner. So, all right, so very high pressure, which means we have a lot of gas molecules crammed into that space. Also, ideal gas law breaks down when the temperature is much lower, much, much lower than 298, than room temperature. Okay? With very low temperatures. I'd say, I don't know, I don't want to put a number, but let's say liquid nitrogen temperature, something like that, less than 50 Kelvin. Maybe. Okay? So colder than we'll get with ice or even CO2 or something, but once we start condensing gases using liquid nitrogen and things like that, then this becomes a factor. With low temperatures, molecules begin to stick together more, reducing the number of collisions with the walls of the container. Okay? So, as the gas molecules are moving fast, they don't really get much of a chance to stick together, okay? To have attractive forces, because they're just going so fast, they just fly right by each other. But as you cool it down, as they're going slower, there's more of a chance that gas molecules will start to cling together. Okay? That's the first principle that causes condensation when you cool things down. But we're talking about before you condense, when we still have a gas. But it's the molecules still start clumping together. So if we think about how this starts to happen, what will the actual pressure be? Will the pressure be higher than we would expect or lower than we would expect? It would be lower, yeah. Pressure would be lower than the prediction. Okay. So if what we're actually getting is lower than what we should be getting, what do you suppose I should do to my ideal gas law? Should I subtract something from P or add something to P? Yeah, I'm going to add something to P. Just like up here, our volume was too high, so I subtracted from that volume to get back to ideal. Okay? With here, pressure is going to become P plus. A little more complicated term, N squared A over V squared, where A is just a constant for intermolecular forces. Okay. Things that we'll be able to classify and quantify later on in this course. But there are tables that have the A and the B constant for various common gases that you can look up. So if one were dealing with a situation where there was a very high pressure or a very low temperature or both, in order to get any kind of accurate calculation, those sort of things would have to be taken into account. So substituting the ideal gas law with these little fix-ups, okay, pressure is this one. Draw it straight here. P plus N squared A over V. Okay, that's one correction for pressure. So, oops, V squared. Thank you. All right. Yeah. PV equals NRT. So for V, we did this correction, V minus NB. That equals and RT. So that's the van der Waals equation. You do not need to memorize that. However, like I said, you should be familiar with why it is we added something to pressure, why it is we subtracted something from volume, okay? Why those are necessary, under what types of conditions something like this would need to be applied. But I will not be eating up your time on the exam substituting into a big equation like that. Okay?
Change the pressure variable.
This will be the actual the calculated volume. This V is the same as that V, in other words. So V minus NB isn't also in there. It's just one V. Okay? So that gets you to something that you could actually calculate. Okay? Does that make sense? So just a little bit of conceptual. It goes right back to the kinetic molecular theory, the things that the assumptions that we made in order to consider those calculations. This is just what to do when those assumptions are no longer true. All right? Questions? Okay. No? Well, let's start chapter 6. I had these notes up on the webpage for a while. So, just got a little bit of stuff to talk about first. Chapter 6 is about thermochemistry. So, study of the relationships between chemistry and energy. When you hear thermo, what do you think of? The heat or temperature or thermometers or something like that. That's only one part of thermochemistry. Okay? Energy is the much more much broader term that we'll use in order to talk about interactions in this chapter. So relationships between chemistry and energy. So remember, the universe is pretty much, from a chemist's perspective anyway, the universe is made out of two things. It's made out of matter and it's made out of energy. So matter is the stuff that takes up volume and has mass to it, the things that you can touch and feel and react and produce and things like that. Okay? Energy is just the capacity to do work. Okay. And work is the result. Here's the physics definition of work. I'll have a little better chemistry definition for you. But the physics definition is the result of a force acting over a certain distance or one way to transfer energy. So what's the physics example? Like pulling a box with a weight or something like that, pushing something over a distance. You have to exert a certain force acting over a certain distance in order to move a box across the room or something like that. Okay? That's an example of work. But we're not going to be talking about pushing things around in chemistry. We're more likely to talk about work as just a method of transferring energy. Okay? So if we take that back here, energy is the capacity to do work. Work is a way of transferring energy. Okay? And then with these different types of energy, we'll talk about how that behaves. But really, what we're talking about, when we talk about work, okay, one type of work is actually pushing an object. Another type of work might, for instance, be an expanding gas that's pushing against a cylinder. So if you run a reaction that produces a gas, that gas will expand and it might push a cylinder up. Or it might expand a balloon outwards. Okay? That would have to be caused by a certain force acting over a certain distance. So that brings it into the chemistry realm a little bit. But also, here, I'll come back to that energy here in just a second once we talk about a couple of types of different energy here. Okay? Kinetic energy is energy of motion, the energy that's related to how something is moving. Okay? Thermal energy is a type of kinetic energy. Thermal energy is energy associated with temperature. What does thermal energy have to do with kinetic energy? How are those two related? How does the temperature of something relate to its kinetic energy?
Motion
of molecules. That's exactly right. The kinetic energy of molecules is directly related to temperature. So as we heat molecules up, they move more. Okay? They end up with more kinetic energy. As we cool them down, they move less. Okay? We talked about that before. So that's why that's indented. Thermal energy is a type of kinetic energy. Right? Let's get that in here. Motion of molecules. Okay? So, thermal energy will be the type of kinetic energy that we're interested in an awful lot in chemistry. Okay? Well, there's kinetic energy and there's potential energy. Energy of position or composition is one way of defining potential energy. The physics example for that would be like an expensive vase or something that's sitting way up on top of a bookshelf, just teetering there. Has an awful lot of potential energy because if a breeze comes along, it has the capability of falling down and breaking into a million pieces. That kinetic energy would be converted into, or that potential energy would be converted into kinetic energy as it falls, and then it breaks apart and makes a noise. Okay? It's converted into all that destructive energy. Okay. So potential energy is just the energy, it's related to what can happen. Okay? What it has the ability to do under certain conditions.
Can you really measure that?
Yeah, you actually can. I mean, with a vase that's falling, it's directly related to how high it is up off of the ground. Okay? With chemistry, it's directly related to what a substance is made of. Okay? So with chemistry, we're not talking about it falling, but we're talking about the energy associated with the composition of a chemical compound. So if it reacts, how much energy could be given off, for instance. If we're burning rocket fuel or something, we're converting the energy that's stored up within that molecule into heat energy, for instance. So chemical energy is the potential energy that's contained within the bonds of the molecules that we're talking about. Okay? So back up here, if the universe is made of matter and energy, okay, matter is all the stuff that there is, and energy is related to how those compounds can, how those molecules and so on can change from one thing to another. Okay? Sometimes energy is absorbed in, sometimes it's released, but it's that flow of energy, really, that determines what reactions can happen, and whether something will heat up or whether something will cool down. Okay? So a lot of times, chemistry itself is said to be the study of matter and its changes. So that's like talking about matter and energy. So we have to have an honest discussion about energy first before we can really talk intelligently about how it is that chemical reactions work and how we can classify them quantitatively and so on. Okay? So I think we've heard of the law of conservation of mass in here. There is a law of conservation of energy as well, in that energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be transferred. And we're very, very interested in that transfer of energy from one substance to another or from one type of energy to a different type, right? Especially from chemical energy into thermal energy. So on. That's the conversion of something in gasoline or rocket fuel into the heat required. Okay? So that transfer of energy is something that we can talk about, that we can measure. Okay? It's usually pretty difficult to measure the energy of just something itself. Okay? But if we can get its energy to be transferred to something else, we can measure that transfer as a way of learning about the original substance. Okay? So, got some common energy units here. The joule is the SI unit of energy. And if you look at its at what it's made of, it's made out of fundamental SI units. It originally comes from being able to, accelerate a 1 kilogram mass by 1 meter per second, per 1 meter per second, or something like that. So that's what a joule is. The calorie, notice the lowercase c here. Calorie is 4.184 joules. The calorie is the most common English unit of heat. So the English system of units, you know, the one that has pounds and inches and gallons and quarts and so on, the calorie is the most common unit. But calorie is very handy because look at what it represents. That's the heat required to heat 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. So if I have a gram of water at 25 C, it'll take a certain amount of heat for it to go to 26 C. Okay? That amount of heat is 1 calorie. So both of these, the joule and the calorie, they're a very small unit of heat. Right? If you just imagine one gram of water, that's a cubic centimeter, right? A little sugar cube worth of water. It's not going to take much for that to go from 25 to 26. Okay? But that's what 1 calorie is. Now, look at this related unit here. Calorie with a capital C is also known as 1 kilocalorie. Okay? So 1,000 calories. So when you see on your food label how many calories something that is, it's actually referring to kilocalories. Okay? So your 100-calorie snack type thing, it actually has 100 times 1,000 of these actual calories themselves. So the food companies are not tremendously careful about their capitalization. So in science, we will be very careful about using a capital C, or even better, just calling them kilocalories. So anytime you get something from a food label or a food scientist or something like that, be careful about what it is that they're calling calories. Okay? The kilowatt hour is sort of a weird unit, but that is used pretty much exclusively by energy companies in measuring the amount of electrical energy that your household is consuming. So the unit that's actually on your electrical meter is in kilowatt hours. That's a measurement of how much energy you have consumed, really, since they started the meter. And it's read every month or something like that. And that's just an actual measurement of energy. That could be converted to joules or calories or anything else like that. I'd say it's a weird unit because, let me show you what. The watt is related to the joule, okay? And then the watt is 1 joule per second. Okay? So joules are an actual amount of energy itself. Okay? But a watt, it's when something is per second, what do we call that? Like meters per second, or what's that? What kind of unit is that called? Well, meters per second is a velocity, but in general, something per second is called a rate. Yeah. So 1 joule per second, that is a rate of energy usage. So why do you suppose it is that hair dryers and light bulbs and stuff have ratings given in watts and not joules or calories or something like that? Because as long as you have it on, it will be consuming a certain number of joules per second. Right? A 100-watt light bulb will consume 100 joules in a second. So where does this come from? Kilowatt hour, right? If I do 60 seconds hour times hour, notice it's not kilowatt per hour, it's kilowatt hour. If I do that times hour, right? Yeah, it's per minute, then 60 minutes per hour. You get the idea, 60 times 60, right? Okay, but what that does, multiplying by that hour, takes away that per time unit and gets you back to just a unit itself. So joules times 60 times 60 is kilowatt hours. Okay. So I say that's sort of a weird unit because I don't know why they don't just use joules, but or kilojoules would be fine. I don't know, but it's a... In the energy industry, they're used to talking about watts and kilowatts and megawatts because that's how much energy can be produced at a power plant over time. So a 100-megawatt power plant puts out 100 million joules per second, for instance. So does that make sense? I don't know why I didn't include this one. Anybody know what unit your furnace or your grill has on it? BTU? Okay. BTU is another unit like this. It actually might be a rate like watt. I might have to look that up, but that's in there somewhere. British thermal unit, something like that. Okay. So another one of these types of units. In this class, joules are king. We're using more and more SI units in the sciences. It used to be even 10 or 20 years ago that calories were used very commonly in chemistry, but we're slowly converting over to using SI units for all of this sort of stuff. So we'll be talking pretty much exclusively in joules, and especially in kilojoules also. 1 kilojoule is how many joules? 1,000 joules. Okay. You had a question?
You said that the joules of the SI unit.
Mm-hmm. No, the SI unit is the standard metric unit. The calorie is the English unit.
Oh.
Calorie is the one that's... So even though it's referring to grams and degrees Celsius, it's an English unit. It's no longer metric. So, but yeah, the joule itself is the SI unit. Okay. Alright. So, any discussion about energy, especially transfers of energy, requires that we define two specific places that energy is coming from and energy is going to. Okay? It'll always be in terms of the system and its surroundings. So, the system is the specific place or substance that we're talking about, and the surroundings is everything else outside of it, continuing on forever. There is no outer edge to surroundings, just an inner edge. Okay? So specifically, if we're talking about a chemical reaction, the system is the chemical reaction itself. For example. So if I'm talking about system and surroundings for some sort of reaction that's happening, the system are the actual molecules that are reacting. So if I have a reaction that's happening within a solution, for instance, a precipitation reaction, okay, one that you've seen where ions combine with each other to make a solid precipitate. Okay, the system are those ions that are combining together to make the precipitate. What about the water that those ions are floating in? Is that the system or the surroundings? Surroundings. Okay? The only thing that's the system are the actual molecules that are reacting. Everything outside of that, so including the water of the solution and the beaker that it's in and the table that it's on and the air that's around it and the room that it's in and so on. Okay? All of that is the surroundings. So we classify those specifically to talk about what direction energy is flowing.
Okay. In an ionic reaction where you end up with a net ionic reaction, is everything in the net ionic reaction considered the system and everything else the surrounding?
That's right. So if you have sodium ions and nitrate ions floating around not participating in the reaction, then those are surroundings. Okay. So the net ionic equation tells you the actual chemical change that's occurring. So that's the system. That's it. All right. So in thermochemistry, systems usually a chemical reaction. It can use heat and work to transfer energy to or from surroundings. Okay? So we're going to have a little better definition of heat here in a little bit, I believe. We won't talk about that just yet. So work, we already talked about, is a way of maybe pushing something, moving something. Heat is another transfer of energy that's used to change temperatures. So that's the difference between heat and energy. We'll talk about that a lot more in a little bit. But heat and work are both ways that energy moves from one place to another. Okay? It'll be useful for us to consider what direction that transfer is going, though. Okay? So let's think about the combustion of natural gas in a furnace. And say we're talking about the actual chemical reaction that's happening there. What is the system in that case? Yeah, the system is natural gas, CH4 plus O2, making CO2 and H2O. Okay. It's not balanced, but here. Now it is. Okay. That's the system. So the reactant and the product molecules actually involved within that reaction. Okay. Surroundings are everything else. So when natural gas burns, what can we say about heat? What can we say happens with heat? Heat is created? Heat, I don't know if it's created, but it's released. That's a little better. Right? And sort of, energy is not created. I guess heat is just the movement of energy from one place to another. Okay? So what's the direction of heat? Do we go from the system to the surroundings or the surroundings to the system? Yeah, system to surroundings. Okay? Because it's chemical energy becoming thermal energy. Okay? And heat is that transfer of energy. Okay. The movement of energy from the bonds within those molecules to becoming thermal energy that heats up the air molecules around it. That transfer is what we call heat. Right? Well, so here's another one. Combustion of gasoline in a car's engine. Right? There's another combustion reaction, so it's going to be gasoline, something like heptane and octane and things like that. So what's the system? Yeah, gasoline plus oxygen making CO2 and water. Okay, your actual reaction is the system. Is energy being transferred from the system to surroundings or surroundings to the system? Yeah, system to surroundings. Okay. So, because that chemical energy is being converted into a couple of types of energy. What's one type of energy that chemical energy is being converted into? What's that? Mechanical energy? Yeah. Let's call it kinetic energy. Mechanical is kinetic. Oops. That chemical energy is also converted into what? Thermal energy? The transfer of one type of energy to thermal energy is called what? Heat. The transfer of one type of energy to kinetic energy is called work. Okay. Right? Work is one way of transferring energy, specifically related to a force acting over a certain distance. This is work. So, when gasoline combusts, it goes from a liquid plus liquid gasoline plus O2, and it makes several more moles of gaseous CO2 and gaseous water. Okay? So, going from fewer moles to more moles, we produce lots more moles of gases. Okay? That gas expands and presses against the piston inside of your car, which moves up and causes the crankshaft to turn, and that's what makes the wheels move. Okay? So that expanding gas of the combustion of gasoline is what actually provides the force, which in turn makes your car move forward. Okay? So that's kinetic energy that it's producing. That chemical energy is being converted, it's being transferred by work to that kinetic energy. It's also being transferred by heat to make the thermal energy that makes the engine heat up and what heats up the air when you turn the heater on in your car, That comes from that energy. Okay? Here's another one. Chemical cold pack. You seen these things? It's just a baggie of powder, and you crush it up. It breaks a little glass vial inside that releases some chemicals to the powder that's around it. They mix together, and it becomes very cold. So all you do is break it up, and then it becomes very, very cold. So what direction is... So something becomes cold, so there's heat involved. There's a transfer of heat energy involved. But which way is the transfer? Is the system giving off heat, or is the system absorbing heat? System is absorbing heat. Surroundings to system. In chemistry and physics, there really is no such thing as cold. Right? Cold is just heat that's transferred thermal energy away from something. So if something feels cold when you hold it in your hand, that means that substance is pulling thermal energy out of your hand. So the flow of heat is going from your hand into that substance. As opposed to when something feels hot, thermal energy is being transferred into your hand. Does that make sense? So cold doesn't move anywhere. Cold is nothing in terms of physics. Cold is just the absence of thermal energy, or thermal energy that's been taken away. So specifically, what happens here, thermal energy becomes chemical energy. We have a reaction that requires energy to be put into it in order for that reaction to happen. So it sucks that energy out of the surroundings, which we perceive as feeling cold. So it can be a little bit confusing, because if you have a reaction like that happening within a container of water, that water will become very cold. So you start to think, well, if that water is cold, how's that heat moving? But the actual system is the reaction itself. As long as you remember that, it's actually pulling heat from the water molecules surrounding it. And that's how the water gets cold. Okay? So keep that sort of stuff on the tip of your tongue. We'll have specific ways of defining these types of heat transfers and so on. Okay? Everybody, anybody have questions so far? Good? All right. Well, there are at least three laws of thermodynamics, which are very important. The first law of thermodynamics, in its simplest state, is that the total energy of the universe is constant. So the law of conservation of energy comes directly from that, okay, which is what energy can be neither created nor destroyed. Okay? So we can't make energy, we can't destroy energy. Okay? The energy of the universe is constant. That becomes complicated a little bit when we start talking about Einstein, E equals mc squared, where every amount of mass has a corresponding amount of energy, and those two can be converted. So this is assuming we're not talking about any kind of mass-energy conversion stuff. Okay? So if the total energy of the universe, though, is constant, what does that mean about perpetual motion? Perpetual motion are things like these machines that traveling salesmen were going around trying to sell for 100 years or so in the 1800s. It was a really big thing. So alleging to have some machine which of its own, which through its own process could take the energy it outputted and use that to make more energy. So usually has some sort of flywheel and then something that turns over and pushes that flywheel again or something like that. So if the total energy of the universe is constant, what does that mean about a perpetual motion machine? So perpetual motion is impossible. Okay. If we in fact did have perpetual motion, that would solve all of our energy issues. You'd have this machine which would be going faster and faster and faster, using its own product to make more and more energy, okay, until it would just explode or something like that. But what they always found when one of these traveling salesmen was selling a perpetual motion machine, is if it was a big, huge machine, then there was always somebody back behind the wall turning a crank on it or something like that. Or if they had it in a little box, they were turning a little wheel underneath it or something. There was always some sort of input, constant input of energy into the system that made it no longer actual perpetual motion. All right. So let's add together some of these energy terms we've talked about, because it'll be handy to talk about them sort of all at once sometimes. So that's what internal energy is. It's a sum of all the forms of kinetic and potential energy within a certain system. So if we're talking a chemical reaction, it's kinetic energy, which when we're talking about molecules, what does kinetic energy refer to? Motion of those molecules, which means what's important about motion of molecules? What's that? Temperature, yeah. Okay. So the kinetic energy, so how fast those molecules are moving, which in turn means how hot they are. Okay. Ooh, we got a little friend up there. As well as the potential energy. So in chemistry, that's the energy that's pent up within the chemical bonds that is able to be released when we do a reaction, or maybe we would need more potential energy to do a different reaction or so on. So if we combine all that together, okay, and talk about all the energy related to a certain system, that's internal energy. And internal energy is a state function. We're going to be referring to at least two or three state functions in this chapter. And that means it depends only on the makeup of the system itself at one point in time and not its history. So, meaning it's not something that adds up over time, it's just something that is intrinsic to that system at the time that you measure it. So, what I said there probably makes no sense, but here, look at this. Change in altitude depends only on the difference between initial and final values, not the path taken. So, here, two paths, right? Here. Can't really see it very well, but there's path B. Okay? It's only 5 miles to get to the top. Path A is snaking all along here. Okay? Takes 12 miles to get to the top. So both of those people, though, climbed the same vertical distance. Okay? They had the same change in altitude. Delta change in altitude is 10,000 feet. That means altitude is a state function. Okay? It depends only on where they are, right? That's their altitude. Okay? Change in altitude only depends on where they are now and where they started. Okay? That's it. Nothing in between. What about these climbers here is not a state function? The distance that they traveled. Okay? Distance is something that adds up as you're going along. So the total distance that they traveled is not a state function. Okay? So we will have, we'll come back to this analogy, because when we're talking about energy, there are things that are state functions and things that are not. And there are specific consequences to that. For instance, the change in any state function can be considered. Like here, the change in altitude, okay, was the same, as long as we started at the same place and ended at the same place. Had nothing to do with what happened in between. So a delta will always be a final minus an initial. Okay? That's one thing to always keep in mind. That will make sure that your values of delta have the right sign. Okay? So change in altitude here was positive 10,000 feet. What if I started at the top and went to the bottom? What would that change in altitude be? Negative 1,000 feet. Okay? Because it's always final minus initial. If I started at the top and ended at the bottom, it would be 0 for final minus 10,000 for initial. Okay? So positive and negative delta values have a very specific meaning. Okay? And it refers to points in time, final minus initial. Okay? If we have any state function, delta is meaningful to us. Something is not a state function, delta is not meaningful to us. Okay? All right. Let's talk work and heat. Okay? The change in a system's internal energy, so the sum of all the kinetic and potential energies, the way that those energies can change depends on how much work was done and how much heat was transferred. Okay? Remember I said work and heat are the two ways that energy can move from one place to another. Okay? So work is W, heat is Q for whatever reason. I don't know. Delta E is Q plus W. Okay? The change in energy is a sum of how much heat was transferred, either in or out, or how much work was done. Okay? The signs of any of these changes always come from the system's perspective. So we're never looking at the surroundings and thinking about how much the surroundings got or how much the surroundings gave away. We're looking at what the system did. The system give it away? Did the system bring energy in? Okay. If energy flows out of the system, delta E would be what? Think in terms of the system. It had a larger amount of energy, and then if energy flows out, what happens to the system's internal energy? It goes down. So if energy flows out of the system, delta E is what?
Negative.
So if energy flows into the system, delta E is positive. Right? You can think of the system a lot of times as like the gas tank on your car. So energy flowing into the system would be like doing what to the gas tank of your car? Think of the gas in your car as being the energy. So if I want energy to flow into, if I want gas to flow into that gas tank, how does that work? Yeah, you put your credit card in, right? So gas going into the gas tank is energy flowing into the system. Okay? How would energy come out of that system? How would gas come out of that gas tank? Yeah, you turn your engine on or somebody comes up and siphons it out with a hose and so on. So in either case, though, right, we could think of the sign of delta E as the change in the amount of gas that's in your gas tank. Okay? As you fill up your gas tank, you went from 2 gallons to 10 gallons. That's a positive change. As you're running your car, your gas is going from 10 gallons down to 2 gallons. That's a negative change. Okay? So it's sort of weird here, but I use that gas tank analogy an awful lot when we're talking about heat. Okay? What's that?
The car in the tank wouldn't actually be part of the system.
Well, it depends on what system we're talking about here. If we're talking about the chemical reaction in the engine, then that's its own system, and heat's flowing out of that. But if we just think about the gas tank and gas flowing into the gas tank or gas coming out of the gas tank could be a system, thinking of it that way. Okay? All right. If heat flows out of the system, Q is what? Oh, how are we going to do that? Well, delta E is Q plus W. Okay? So delta E, okay, Q plus W. If heat flows out of the system, okay, delta E was negative. But let's think about Q here. Is that going to work? Any ideas? Sort of depends on what W is. The reason I sort of use the gas tank analogy, think of it as simply in terms of that gas tank there. Okay, heat is flowing out of the system. Okay? By definition, Q is positive for that. Okay, heat flows into the system. Q is negative. Okay? And we'll define those a little bit later on. It's a little bit backwards. We'll talk about that as we go on a little more though. Okay. So, what's next? Measuring heat, or even better, how about calculating the amount of heat transferred once. It's a little better heading. All right. So, remember I said it's very difficult for us to see actually how much energy is within something at a certain point in time. Okay? That would be like a car where we didn't have a gas gauge. Okay? But what we can do, we can measure how much heat comes into or how much heat goes out of a system. For instance, we could measure how long our car is running, or we could measure how much gas we put in the tank. Okay? And sort of back it out that way. So it says, heat always transfers thermal energy from areas of what temperature to areas of what temperature? Let's think about this. High temperature to low temperature, that's right. Okay. If there is no such thing as cold, for specifically this reason, that if I have something that's hot, its energy will transfer by heat to something that's cold until then, or until their temperatures are in equilibrium with each other. Okay? So that's good to know. Heat capacity is a specific unit that we can use. It's the heat required to raise the temperature of an object by 1 degree Celsius. And that's related very closely to that calorie definition we talked about a little bit ago when it was dealing with water. So, heat capacity. And specifically, this is of an object. So, a certain object will have a certain amount of heat that is required to change its temperature. So, units will be joules per what? Any idea? Is that louder?
Meters cubed.
Meters cubed? Well, if we're just talking about an object, not necessarily the size of the object or anything, just one object. If I have this object and I want to raise its temperature by a degree Celsius, the unit would be joules per degree Celsius. Right? Simple. Right? So 1 joule per degree Celsius means it takes 1 joule to raise it up by 1 degree. Okay? 10 joules per degree Celsius and so on. Does that make sense? Okay. Specific heat capacity is the heat required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of a substance by 1 degree Celsius. The difference here is this was per some object, okay? This block of metal or this container or something like that. This is per 1 gram of water or aluminum or gold or something like that. Okay? So this is joules per what? Per gram? Per degree Celsius. Okay? So per gram per degree Celsius. Okay? So our textbook calls regular old heat capacity C and specific capacity C sub S. Okay? And specific has sort of a different meaning than we would think. Okay? If it were in normal terms, we'd be thinking that one would be talking about a specific object, but it doesn't work that way. Specific means per a certain mass, or per a certain number of moles, or something, or per mole, or something like that. Okay? So whenever we see specific, that's for a certain amount of a bulk substance. Anyway, so our book calls it C sub S. A lot of other places call it just S. Okay? So in here, I'll try my best to call it C sub S. I'm used to calling it S from before, so if it slips in, that's what it is. Our experiment this week, I don't remember if we've changed it to C sub S, but it used to be in terms of S. Anyway, so what's that? It's in S? Okay, so we might have to change it, but be able to use both of those. So heat capacities would be measured and would be given for a certain type of object. Specific heat capacity is in tables that you can look up for something like water or something like aluminum or gold or something like that. That makes sense? There are no tables of heat capacity because it's for particular objects. All right. Let's calculate how heat transfer works. Okay? For an object, Q is the amount of heat that is transferred, whether into or out of a substance. Okay? What unit would Q have? Degrees? No? Heat is a transfer of what? Energy. So it's going to be an energy unit. What's our favorite energy unit I told you about? Joules. Okay. So Q will be in joules. Okay. There are a couple ways to do this. Okay. Here's a heat capacity. Okay. So if I know the heat capacity of a substance, that's joules per degree Celsius. That's C. Then what do I have to multiply that by? Yeah. C times change in temperature. That's in degrees Celsius. So these are the symbols, these are their respective units. You should be able to see how degrees Celsius can cancel there. Okay? So the amount of heat transferred is equal to that object's heat capacity times the change in temperature. So we could calculate, for instance, if an object has a heat capacity of 10, right, joules per degree Celsius, and we raise it by 10 degrees, how much heat was transferred? 100 joules, right? So if I raise its temperature even more, that would require more heat to be transferred. Okay? So it depends on the object as well as the change in temperature. What is a positive change in temperature and what is a negative change in temperature? Think about final minus initial. Delta T could be a positive value or a negative value. If I have positive delta T, what does that mean? What does that mean temperature is doing? Think about it. Delta T equals T final minus T initial. So a positive delta T means temperature is going which way? Up. Okay. So a negative delta T means temperature goes down. Okay? So alrighty. For a certain mass of a substance, we're no longer going to use C. I need to use C sub S, or just S. So still joules. Joules per specific heat capacity had what units to it? What did I say? Per gram. Per degree Celsius. Okay? So specific heat capacity has to be multiplied by what? Mass in grams times what? Temperature, but change in temperature. Okay? So, if I have a specific heat capacity, I have to multiply in how many grams of that substance we did. Okay? So, you can do that. I have a table of specific heat capacities. Yeah. Let's do that here. How much energy is required to heat 50 grams of water from 25 to 100 feet? So, I have to look up water. There it is. plug those numbers in and get an answer in a proper unit. Get out your calculator, actually. Actually type them in. What's delta T? What unit will your answer be in? Joules? Okay. How many sig figs will the answer have? Three? So, somebody get an answer? Yeah. 15.7 times 10 to the third, about 1.57 times 10 to the fourth, if we're using regular scientific notation. Is it engineering notation that has two digits?
Groups of three.
Yeah, oh, that's right, groups of three, because it makes the units easier. Okay. 10 to the fourth.
15.7
units. Yeah. So, kilojoules are the more convenient unit. We just go divide by 1,000. Okay. I guess that's why engineering notation is useful, because it lets you do kilo and milli and micro pretty easily like that. So, anyway, 15.7 kilojoules would probably be a more appropriate answer for this. You will normally be asked what unit to give your heats in. But if I ask for it in joules, it should be something like that. If I ask for kilojoules, make that appropriate conversion. Here's a neat little calculation. It's not entirely realistic, because when you have water on a hot plate, is all of that heat going directly into the water? No. If you hold your hand next to it, it feels warm. So obviously some of that heat is coming out into the surroundings, but assume you had a perfect hot plate that was no bigger than the beaker of water that it was on, and all the heat got reflected directly into the container of water. Okay. Using that sample up there, we could figure out how long it will take for a 1,000-watt hot plate. Some of the hot plates we have are 1,000-watt, some are a little less. Okay. So how long will this take a 1,000-watt hot plate to do? And here's my clue again. 1 watt is 1 joule per second. So if I do joules, 1.57 what can I do with that 1,000 watts? If a watt is a joule per second, 1,000 watts is what?
1,000 joules
per second. So, what can I put on the bottom of a conversion here?
1,000 joules
per 1 second. So, right, it's pretty much the same as doing something like that, right? 15.7. seconds. So it's interesting. If you're in watts, okay, if you do watts, right, that will let you go from joules to seconds. Pretty interesting. So 1,000 watts will transfer, it'll go from kilojoules to seconds. Sorry, that's what I meant. 1,000 watts, 1,000 watts will do kilojoules into seconds. I've used that as a rule of thumb before. I don't remember for what, but Anyway, that's just because 1 watt will go just straight from joules to seconds. So if I had a 1,000-watt hot plate, 50 grams of water isn't an awful lot. That's like 50 milliliters, so that's your little beaker. If I had a big hot plate that had all of the heat focused in, I'd be able to go from room temperature to just starting to boil in 15 seconds. So it gives you an idea how much heat is actually lost to the atmosphere when we're using one of those hot plates, right? Pretty small sample, but that's not going to take any 15 seconds for it to start boiling. It'll take a couple minutes, really. So, all right, I think we're done for today. We'll keep going on this, do some more calculations. Our lab ties in very nicely to this sort of stuff, so I'll meet you over there in 15 minutes. What is it? It's groups again today. The procedure says to use the same groups that we did for magnesium and HCl, but you've been commingling so much, I'll just let you pick whatever groups you like for today. So.